Hi, welcome to Fave This, a podcast about fandom, video games, and internet culture. I'm Gita Jackson, and you might have noticed that usually Patricia Hernandez does this intro, but she's sick this week. So, and last week, we were both very sick. So while Patricia recovers, I'm here joined by Kotaku staff writer Heather Alexandra.
Hello, I am Heather Alexandra. That is me. I am not Patricia Hernandez. That is not me.
That's not who you are.
100% not.
So Heather Alexandra is my dear friend who
dearest.
I love very, very much.
Well, maybe not dearest.
Not dearest, dear.
Okay.
I said dear.
Okay, that's fine.
You're in the top 10. Well, I would say you're in the top 10.
Are you kidding me? That's amazing.
Yeah.
No. I love it.
And she, while she's not writing about speedrunning and doing news hits and doing incredible critical analysis of games like Wolfenstein, she streams games on Kotaku's very own Twitch channel.
All the time. Way too much. I sometimes stream for like 4 or 5 hours, depending. We did a Stardew Valley stream,
I think,
2 weeks ago. And it was close to almost 6 hours. Maybe I'm wrong getting that off. I don't know, because that game's amazing. So yeah, we started up our Twitch channel, I want to say 7 months ago. We had already, we'd always had one.
Yeah.
But it was just kind of dormant. And I think it's a good way for us to connect and spend time with folks. I would love to have like you and Patricia and other people join up. It's just a matter of making sure everybody has the right equipment and the right games and the time.
Yeah, the time is a big factor. I did sneak into and watch one of your streams,
and
it was really, really fun. You were playing a game, a David Cage game.
I was playing, so we played Heavy Rain.
Yeah.
Which I know David Cage, like everybody has problems with David Cage in the sense
True.
That he is, his games are not great to women. There's this whole scene, like a hidden scene in Indigo Prophecy where he's dancing with one of the female characters in the game, but she's in her underwear. Like, it's
That's
so
weird.
He's weird.
What a weird man.
But there are things about Heavy Rain that I really, really like, even though that game doesn't always work either.
Yeah.
He's going to make Detroit, which I'm sure is going to be fine.
I'm going to not say anything.
Oh, we could talk. We could talk forever.
This episode could be about Detroit, but I brought Heather onto the show because I wanted to talk about something that's like a running theme on the Twitch channel. You stream games that are kind of campy.
Yeah, I think so. A little bit offbeat.
Yeah.
We try and balance it so there's some action games and then narrative games. And most of the narrative games that we've played have been kind of silly or a little kind of B-movie-ish.
Yeah. Can you define camp for me?
All right.
I'm sure there's something John Waters said that's like.
So, I mean, I'm not going to be able to pull like a John Waters quote or anything. But so camp is, it's one of two things, right? It's either the perception of like a sort of offbeat or really quirky quality that maybe isn't necessarily intentional. So the way that I always parse that one is when I think of bad voice acting in Resident Evil.
Yeah.
This kind of exaggerated version of acting or presentation that is a bit more along the lines of like, no, you're not saying, oh my God, it's oh my God.
Yeah. So camp comes from theater, right?
Right.
I think that's, you know, forgive me for butchering this history, but it comes from this tradition of acting that exists slightly outside of reality and takes normal human interactions and turns them into things that are totally absurd.
Yes. So it's partially about broadness and making things larger. And so you're inverting kind of normal social behaviors or at least social values about like beauty or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So excessive makeup, right?
Yeah.
So drag has a quality of camp to
it,
for instance. That's its own very specific type of camp, and it's a very directed, focused type of camp.
But it's like a squares and rectangles thing.
Yeah, a little bit, right?
You know?
But camp is largely this exaggeration of sort of the normal qualities of things that we would consider everyday interactions or whatever. There's a broadness to it. There's a sort of celebratory exaggeration.
Yeah. Well, this is why you end up, camp has ended up being extremely queer. It's basically a tradition of queerness.
Hell yeah.
And celebrated by queer people.
Super good times.
Because camp really is about positivity. It's about taking things that are kind of bad and saying, no, that's me.
Gita.
No, I love this.
Gita.
Yeah.
What if bad things were actually really good?
What?
I know. Oh, no. Yeah. Said the wise man.
So right now on our Twitch channel, you are playing Deadly Premonition, which is an incredible game.
The wonderful, wonderful Deadly Premonition.
It is also garbage.
Yes. Well, okay. I have thoughts about Deadly Premonition, and we can talk about it, but we can also use it to talk about camp broadly. Yeah. So Deadly Premonition is this game by a fellow named Hidetaka Suihiro. Mm. He's also called Suiri65, all capital letters, so you know he's auteur-y, which is good. I met him once. He had a stuffed monkey, and he was very glad to show off the stuffed monkey. Good
he
for him.
He seems like a nice man.
Suiri seems like a very good man. If people have been keeping up with some of the news, they might have been familiar with his failed FIG campaign for a game called The Good Life.
It was a murder mystery in a small town where at night everyone turns into cats.
Everybody turns into cats. So this is a fellow with a very strange sort of way of looking at the world. He sort of takes vintage Americana, or like the Japanese perception of certain forms of Americana, small town life and things like that, and he exaggerates them a lot. So Deadly Premonition is this story. It takes a lot of cues from Twin Peaks, where there's a murder in a Pacific Northwestern town, and there's an FBI agent who is sent in to sort of find out what's going on there. The townsfolk are all really, really weird. There's this aspect of magical realism to it. Everything is huge. There's the best scene in the game, Gita, is when, so the FBI agent, his name is Francis York Morgan. He is sitting inside of a diner, and there's this guy, his name is Harry. He's like the rich guy in town, but he's in a wheelchair and he wears a mask and he has a servant sidekick who speaks for him in rhyme.
Chill. Okay.
Very big, very strange. Mm-hmm. And the entire scene is that he orders a sandwich that is turkey and jam and cereal. And York is like, it's the sinner's sandwich. He's eating it as a form of penance.
Oh, my God.
And then he tries it, and he's like, no, this is just, like, a really freaking good sandwich.
So the one sweary scene for me that, like, is indicative of what camp is when you're doing it on purpose is the scene from Dark Dreams Don't Die. Where they start talking about clam chowder.
Yes.
So in this scene, it's set in Boston.
Boston.
Which is a city I'm sure Sweary has been
Sweary's to. Sweary's version of Boston.
Yeah, this is not real Boston.
No, this is Boston.
This is Boston as filtered through a Japanese man's interpretation of what people are like
it's
there.
It's fucking Boston.
Yeah, so you've lived in Boston for a little bit.
Hell yeah.
Do you like clam chowder?
Wicked love clam chowder.
Clam chowder is pretty good.
Chowder's good.
But in this scene, so one, they're talking like that, like cartoon character version of a Boston
100%.
Accent. 100%. And then the scene, they just start screaming about how good clam chowder is in Boston. And how the Boston clam chowder is the only clam chowder.
The difference between New England clam chowder and like New York clam chowder. Mm-hmm. For those of you who don't know, let me tell you, because this is important to me too. New England clam chowder is amazing. It is white and creamy and fantastic. New York clam chowder and some other things, it's like this red broth.
It's weird.
It's bullshit.
It's weird bullshit.
But the aspect of camp that comes through in a lot of those conversations, especially centering around food, right? If camp is this inversion of normal mores or behaviors, right? It's taking the action of how we handle our interactions at the table and talking with each other and how that's a social thing, and instead making that broader. So it's not just...
So this is like, I'm sure, a version of a conversation that Sweary has heard in real life. People do talk about how the difference between New England clam chowder and New York clam chowder.
I was traveling. I remember the first time I was ever traveling, I went through Philadelphia and I got clam chowder and it was not New England clam chowder.
Oh,
and
no.
I had a good conversation with my waiter what is this thing?
I lived in Chicago for many years, and as much as I like Chicago-style hot dogs, Chicago-style pizza is bullshit. New York style pizza is the only way to go.
Yeah, of course.
Got to fold it. You got to be able to fold it.
It's all droopy, but then you fold it a little bit. It's less droopy.
Exactly. It's got the thin crust.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot of sauce. Anyway, that is a way that people talk. But in this scene, like at a certain point, they start talking about pizza as well, and they like take out a pizza box.
He just starts eating.
They just start eating it voraciously. Like
it's this big, burly guy. His name's Forrest Kaysen, and he starts taking pieces and stacking them on top of each other.
Yeah, he eats like eight at a time, and it's animated so that it looks like his jaw is like unhinging in order for him to swallow them.
Super big.
And it was It rides this line. So I think the problem with like video game fandom is that people sometimes assume when things like that happen, it's a mistake. Mm-hmm. But camp is something that has existed in all forms of media. And,
right.
I mean, Japan has its own very rich tradition of camp. If you watch anime at all, you probably have a very good idea of what I'm talking about.
Sweat drops.
Sweat drops.
There you go.
And, you know,
exaggeration, just in general. It happens a ton in anime.
Yeah. Japanese film as well. Like, Japanese comedies rely on camp very frequently. I'm thinking particularly of Takashi Miike's adaptation of Ace Attorney, where he translates the exaggerated conventions of anime into a live action thing. And that is the whole joke.
Right.
That, you know, people don't behave this way.
And when you think about it that way, that's where you see sort of the tradition of where it's arising out of theater, where mm-hmm. when you're on theater, like even when you're doing, quote unquote, realistic acting on theater is still far more broad than anything you would ever do in real life, mm-hmm. because it needs to read to a room of tons of people, unless you're doing theater for a handful of folks at some sort of private performance. Like, theaters are big, mm-hmm. and sometimes you're in a theater in the round, or you're in a three-quarter thrust or whatever, and so you have to make sure you have all these angles and all this bullshit. So you have to be really, really broad. And so theater has this tradition of, like, you know, you don't just point, but you point.
Yeah.
You can't see it, audience, but I just pointed my arm.
Oh my God, okay.
Really big.
So...
And that happens in games and animations, like you were saying.
Yeah, well, animation by nature has to be exaggerated. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this thing where in these in-between motion frames, the artist will draw them as a little bit blurred.
Yes, or they'll frames.
Yeah, they'll distend like the arm a little bit in order to create the impression of a great force being enacted upon it.
Faces just kind of turn into these little putty messes for about like 2 frames at most to give that sort of perception of motion.
So in games, because games rely on animation, they do have to engage in some of these same things. But there's also an intentional, like, I think games and theater are very closely related.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, when you are seeing a play, it does feel interactive because the actor is relying on you to respond to what they are saying. Like, the absence of that wall there, that invisible fourth wall, allows you to feel closer to the actor than, say, watching it on a movie.
Sure. And certain games are more open about that theater influence too. So I played through and reviewed Tacoma for the site, and that is basically a video game version of Sleep No More. And it's that idea of being able to move through space and interact with things. And that's a very performance art sort of sensibility of going into spaces and following characters. So there is definitely that overlap between theater and games in a lot of ways. If I do want to tangent just for a second, because I want to get this out before I forget about it.
Yeah.
It's this, I think, so you were talking about these broad animations and smears mm-hmm. and things like that. And I think that sometimes when players push back against that, it's because there's this big push in games for like high graphical fidelity or really realistic graphics to draw them in. Everything has to be immersive, but camp by its very nature is not very immersive at all.
No, camp calls attention to itself. Yeah, camp wants you to notice it.
It's this very Brechtian thing, right, where... So Bertolt Brecht, for those of you who don't know, I'm not going to go into all of his stuff, but one of the things that he does when he wants to really do things in theater is he wants the audience to be aware of the theater as a space and sort of the separation between the actors and the audience themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Camp is a variation of that, right?
Yeah.
So Brecht wants there to be isolation is what he wants, and alienation between things. And I think camp in games, particularly Deadly Premonition, because when Deadly Premonition came out, the review scores, even though review scores are shit as a concept, like people's thoughts on that were just so different. Like, people were like, this is charming and endearing and weird. And other people were like, it makes no sense. People are doing weird stuff and the combat's wrong.
Yeah,
and
I feel like sometimes with video games, people take something campy and they're like, what do I even do with this?
Right. We're not used to that.
Yeah. So my favorite example of a camp game is Metal Gear Solid 2.
Metal Gear Solid 2. A smart game with a bunch of ridiculous shit.
Ah, the vamp stuff. Vamp is like a character straight out of camp.
Listen,
like, the vamp is a camp character.
He's not called vamp because he's a vampire, okay?
He's called vamp because he's a fucking vamp.
He's a bisexual, you fool. That's the whole conversation. Raiden's like, oh, he's a vampire. And Snake's like, no, he's a
he's bisexual. Ugh.
Yeah, where this game also finds its camp that is so interesting to me is in this absurd, like, overextension of what it means to be masculine and powerful.
Right.
So Raiden is one version of, like, masculine power, right? He's beautiful, effeminate, but beautiful, sleek, and, like, ninja-esque in a way that men are allowed to be. And then Raiden, or not Snap, Snake.
Is. Snake is the...
Snake so, is a big, gruff... He is Kurt Russell.
He's that. Kurt Russell... It's a good thing you said that, too, because his name in that game that he uses for his fake name is Iroquois Plissken.
That is so
which
funny.
Is a reference to Escape from New York. So that's right on the money.
Yeah. And there he uses. So, God, I feel dumb, but I forgot the name of the man.
Hideo Kojima. There you go.
Wow. That's weird. That's it's a okay. weird feeling to have that name.
He probably forgets it all the time, too. Sure. He just calls himself God.
And he calls himself
Mads Mikkelsen's best friend. Ever.
They're best friends.
Hannibal pals.
I love their friendship so much.
Mm-hmm.
It is so cute. I wonder how Mads feels about it, though, because it's, like, so clear that, like, Hideo was just fanboying, like, so hard all the time.
I wonder how Norman Reedus feels about it.
Oh, shit.
Because Norman Reedus, when Hideo Kojima was going to make Silent Hills with Guillermo del Toro, mm-hmm. like, Norman Reedus was his guy. And then now that he's doing Death Stranding? I forget the gosh dang
Who
name. I always space out
Mostly
on that.
Mostly what Hideo is doing now. Is writing weird movie reviews for Rolling Stone. So,
yeah,
like, let's not worry about it too much.
He's just showing up like, this is what I think of Blade Runner. And you're like, are you the... You're the guy who did Solid.
I guess we're going to see Death Stranding in like 2030, dude.
It's going to be a while.
It's going to be a very long time if that game even comes out. So far, we've gotten a couple of really interesting animated trailers.
Yes.
And that may be what it is.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
But yeah, so Hideo Kojima very deliberately uses these two archetypes of masculinity, one that is derided but still sort of like a powerful image of the, well, and of something that also is more powerful in Japan, right? That effeminate,
sort of
waifish man.
Effeminate, sort of like really attractive individual.
So he pushes that so hard that Raiden becomes this incredibly irritating guy, right? Like his deference to authority makes him into a fool. But then you take Snake, and Snake is so, like, ridiculously masculine, he becomes a total fucking cartoon character.
He's a little bit of a self-parody.
Yeah.
Which people don't get, and that's almost part of the point of that game, too. People played Metal Gear Solid 1, and they were like, this is awesome. But Snake gets fucked over in Metal Gear Solid 1 all the time. It's not cool.
Oh, yeah.
It's this action pastiche that also says, like, oh, being an action hero is terrible. But because it's so broad with, like, psychics that do this big thing and, like, behind all the camp sort of action.
Yeah.
I think sometimes the camp action and the earnestness of some of what's going on there kind of obfuscated some of those points. So maybe camp sometimes can distract from that.
Yeah, because, like, part of the reason why people bounce off of Metal Gear Solid 2 is because it's also fundamentally just a mechanically very good stealth game.
Right.
Like, if you are there, to just play a very good stealth game,
yeah,
the
good
20-minute cutscenes that happen once after you walk in a hallway are going to piss you off.
You don't need, like, Fortune standing there with, like, a saxophone in the background and being like, why can't I die? And then, like, Vamp being like, it's okay, queen.
I love Vamp so much.
No, it's all right.
It's Phil Lamar.
Oh, God. So Heather does a lot of really good impressions.
I don't know if that's true.
That's true. Can you do your Tim just for a minute?
Tim Rogers from Kotaku.com?
Yeah.
Oh, so I'm going to make this video about Bubsy. I don't like him. I don't like that. Yeah, no, I played it and it's not good.
Sorry. So that's just my, if you haven't watched what Tim is doing for you,
professional video game expert Tim Rogers.
He was born stupid.
However,
he will not die hungry.
Will not die hungry.
All right. So do you have any closing thoughts on camp?
I think that the push towards broader, like, fidelity in games is kind of bringing games away from the tradition of theater in camp. But I think creators like Sweary, when I look also, for instance, even though it's not as clear anymore, and this is another Japanese fellow with a proper auteur name, Suda51, when you look at something like Let It Die and The Broadness, and that was last year, it's a free-to-play game, it's super good. I think there are people out there who are preserving a sense of broadness and
theatricality.
Yeah, like real theatricality.
Yeah, like
in
performance.
Games.
But part of playing a game is performing within it.
Yeah, of course.
Right? So I feel like the reason why I don't really care for games that are all about being real is because I don't enter a game space in order to enjoy more realness. I enter it to enjoy some kind of fantasy.
And it's a whole different topic of discussion, but the game, video games' idea of real is not close to being real.
We could talk about that forever.
We could.
But we promised the people creepypasta.
We did.
And we got to talk about
creepypasta. Well, you promised them, but we can. I can talk
if
about
you
some creepypasta.
Screen this
you
week.
Know way more about this than I do.
Okay.
Because I was like this internet waif that hid in a corner while where all the fandom wars and creepypasta was happening. I was just like, I'm over here like on my RP forums like, oh, Gundam. And then you have all these awesome stories.
Yeah, no, I am really into spooky stuff. Like October is basically my favorite month.
Yes.
Because it comes right after my birthday month, which is also my favorite month. And when you go to Target, you can buy a lot of home goods that have ghosts on them.
All sorts of ghosts.
All sorts of ghosts, all sorts of skeletons.
Ghouls.
I love spooky shit. And this got me thinking, you know, all October, I should revisit some of my favorite creepypasta, specifically from the SCP Foundation.
Tell me about them because I don't know what this is.
Okay, so the SCP Foundation is a wiki that's edited just by people on the internet. It's just a collection of sort of, it's like an anthology that sort of feels like Twilight Zone-y sometimes.
Okay.
The story is the SCP Foundation is this secret government agency that works, so secret, nobody knows about it.
I'd never heard of them until now.
They classify and capture different sort of metaphysical and supernatural objects.
Right.
And it works really well as a wiki because that means you don't actually have to write a full story. You can just write a really good idea you had for a monster, and then that can take off. One of my favorite entries on the SCP Foundation is this one where it's just like a weird grinder. And if you can add things to it, put things inside one slot and they'll come out the other slot.
Okay.
And it has a couple of different settings, like fine and rough. And what it'll do is, based on what you put into it, like have different combinations of thing, you know.
Ooh.
So you could put a penny.
I'm down with this.
You can put a penny into it and put it on fine and it'll come out as a brand new penny.
That's a fine penny.
Or if you put it on rough, it'll come out as little pieces of copper.
That's a very rough penny.
And like that is like a very fascinating idea. Like they put human flesh and they put it on fine and it came out as redacted.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's like
ooh.
Yeah, so like they have another entry that I absolutely love.
Okay.
That is a tape of a 1990s like basketball game. DeVry University.
Who has a basketball team? Who knew?
They didn't.
John Boyce knew. John Boyce.
So the tape, when you play it, the players of the game begin to become self-aware. Like, they understand they're on the tape.
Oh, fuck this.
And every time you play it, they remember what happened last time, and so they develop as a society.
This is just Doki Doki Literature Club.
It's a little bit. It's Doki Doki Literature Club. I clearly I have a type of thing
yes,
that I love.
Yes, you do, but so, it's good because this is not stuff that I knew.
Yeah, and like I what is really amazing about Creepypasta is that these are all things that are sort of owned by this community now. Like, if you wanted to make I think there is a SCP Foundation game and I haven't played, but if you wanted to take any of these stories and make them into a movie, well, you're kind of shit out of luck. This isn't something that can be, like, adapted,
yeah, it's just
really
a sort of separate collection of all these different kind of objects or characters or something, by the way, that you're kind of sort of explaining it to me, that you can just kind of get the gist of, but not, like, a full branching narrative. Although some creepypasta are, like, really extended narratives.
Yeah, I mean, I know the Slender thing. That it
oh,
was
God.
Just came from – Slenderman just came from a Photoshop Friday forum thread on – the Something Awful
I was
going to
say, that's Something Awful.
Yeah. And it's just someone photoshopped into the background of a picture a tall man with no face.
Tallest
and
dude with no face.
It just took off. And then Slenderman the 8 Pages came out. And there's just a multitude of different creepypasta about Slenderman coming to get you in the night. If you've ever been to an anime convention, you will know that very tall people like to cosplay Slenderman and then just stand right outside of doorways. They love doing that. I hate it.
I want no part of everything you just said.
I know there's also, there's like a bunch of different web series that are internet creepypasta. That Petscop game,
that was a YouTube series.
Patricia
that wrote
about
that. I wish Patricia was here. She knows so much more about that. It's like a fake PlayStation 1 game.
Yeah, it's an very impressive project. It's definitely
it's
fake.
Really, really robust.
Yeah, but someone made an animated what looks like a very convincing fake PS1 game.
It looks like it would be made by the same people who made like LSD Dream Simulator or something. It's pretty out there.
But why do you think creepypasta about video games is so appealing to people? Like Ben Drowned is another thing.
Okay,
like,
so Ben Drowned. Ben Drowned is actually like one of the only ones I know.
Yeah.
So this is a story about a cursed copy of Legend of Zelda Majora's Mask. I said that weird. I don't know the full story beats, but essentially the idea is that it's haunted by this ghost of somebody named Ben, and the save file eventually changed to say Ben Drowned. First it said Ben, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And a bunch of just like bad stuff just happened to people while they were playing this cartridge. So they would – and the video – there's like video to go with it, which is really, really cool. Somebody made the video.
Yeah.
And so Link will just be running around and then he'll hover in the air and get burnt alive on fire. And then when the camera pans around, the happy mask guy who has this really big, terrifying smile will be like, oh, you've suffered a terrible fate, haven't you? It's just this whole idea of sort of game worlds that have sort of like what you were saying before, maybe not agency, but these spaces that we don't have control over. And I think the appeal for video game creepypasta is specifically this notion of, I think for a while, people didn't understand technology. So technology is just scary in general.
Mm-hmm.
And then also this idea of building worlds and what may or may not happen in those worlds. And like this, we don't have concepts in games that are like, separation of, you know, in theater, it's like there's a fourth wall. In games, it's just like everything's kind of blurry.
Yeah. I mean, one of the biggest creepypasta ever is the Lavender Town story.
Right. The ghosts.
The ghosts. And that not only is a great ghost story, but it answers a question that's not really talked about in the game, which is something that's really scary. It's like, what happens to Pokemon if they die?
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. We don't know. And someone took that weird tension of Pokemon where it wants to be kid friendly so no one ever faints. No one ever dies. They just faint, right? Yeah. And gave it a very terrifying answer.
Yes.
And that obviously appeals to us because one, Pokemon saturates our culture. But two, like, because it is just part of our lives, it's disturbing when we can't like reconcile them with our actual lives.
I think Creepypasta 2, if I'm being really speculative, I think it ties into like gamers and nerds and all sorts of folk and geeks, whichever, take your pick. they love to appeal to this notion of canon, which mm-hmm. also means like theorizing. So there's this idea of like, we want something that's definitive, mm-hmm. right? And once you have the idea of like a definitive universe or timeline or a playthrough of a game, like there's that. That's locked in stone and that's the thing we'll appeal to. But I think there's also this desire to want to have these strange deviations from that canon because those deviations end up feeling sort of dangerous or yeah. forbidden. And so when you tell ghost stories or creepypasta or like this is kind of partially the appeal of fan fiction, right? Is yeah. like taking this thing that you think is locked and adding a degree of unpredictability yeah. Or intrigue to it that didn't already exist, like creating these different yeah. pathways. And yeah. I think that creepypasta kind of appeals to that instinct a little bit.
So the default format of a creepypasta usually is a story of I'm telling this to you.
Right.
So a lot of these show up, they originated from the supernatural board on 4chan or different threads on Something Awful where people try to freak each other out for scary stories. I know that No Sleep Now is this sort of subreddit on Reddit dedicated to just new creepypasta stories. But usually because of this format, they end up being like, hey, I found this creepy video game cartridge.
Yeah. The thing
I bought this book, this journal at a tag yeah. sale, and it had something weird in it.
The thing that I was always going to try and compare them to, I think, in my head is it's basically like the video game version. I mean, even though like that happens, like Outlast is an example of this mm-hmm. within its fiction, but this is kind of like the video game version of a found footage thing.
A little bit, yeah.
Where you're like, oh, like video people game. Died making Blair Witch. And
just
you're
like the internet age yeah, right. version of what just found. Okay, so one of my favorite creepypasta ever.
Let's
it was
go.
On No Sleep. It is this one where there's a character who's saying, so my friend committed suicide and before he committed suicide, he just started talking to me about this song he remembered. And try as I might, I couldn't find the song online anywhere, any recording of it. And I ended up emailing the AR rep that signed the band that did it. And he tells this very long story about how this is a band that got famous really quickly for a song that was mediocre, one of those like mid-2000s electro pop things. And they had this really creepy, you know, like manager with them at all times, and they refuse to do anything without him. So one day the lead singer's model girlfriend gets in a car crash and her face is totally disfigured and they can't fix it. So the lead singer of the band freaks the fuck out, has a whole like huge argument with this creepy manager, and the manager leaves and curses them out and says that they're never going to be famous.
This is just the story of replacement Avril Lavigne.
So they write one more song and
yes.
that song gets more popular than anything that they've ever recorded.
Okay.
And that song, however, people would call into radio stations in a frenzy requesting it, like unable to think about anything else, only listening to that song. And eventually they would kill themselves after listening to it on end. And, you know, the band broke up. There was an incident where they had to, like, just remove that song from rotation entirely and try to, like, eradicate any trace of it from online. Like, the government got involved. And this character, the AR rap is sort of like, here's a snippet of it. I recorded it at a dressing room a couple years ago because every time I hear it, I'm supposed to send that, like, let the government know so that no one can listen to it. And the post ends with the MP3 of that song.
Okay.
And the lyrics go something like, you know,
and
he told
I
me
said,
that I did.
What about? I'm sorry.
The lyrics go something like, he told me that he'd take something, but I didn't know that he'd take your, and then the chords are F-A-C-E.
Oh.
And then the post ends with, you know, now that I've heard it, it was as good as I remember. Life just seems like it was so much better back when the song was on the air.
Oh.
It is remarkable. So like the effort that goes into that kind of thing. He wrote a song.
It's like well-crafted. There's all these different parts to it.
Yeah. So it's a convincing story that ties into something that I remember, like the music of that time. And then it's a very typical sort of deal with the devil kind of thing on top of it. But what makes it feel convincing is he recorded the song, and then a snippet he uploaded to YouTube, though, does sound like it was hastily recorded on a phone.
Kind of a tinny quality and things like that.
Yeah, it's very fuzzy, very staticky. So if, you know, the original purpose of Creepypasta was purely to freak people out and to make them believe things. Smile Dog, which was written by Michael Lutz, who is... He came out and told people that he wrote Smile Dog after The Bye Bye Man. That movie totally ripped off some of the assets he made for it.
Oh, I didn't know about that.
Yeah, The Bye Bye Man absolutely ripped off Smile Dog.
The story that you're telling me makes me think, I guess the closest video game equivalent of that is a game called, I think it's Polybius, which was supposedly a...
Oh, yeah, like that urban legend
this, like,
game.
This wild arcade game, kind of, I think it was kind of like a vector graphics game the same way of like Battle Zone or something like that. And I don't remember the specifics of this, even though I wanted to look into it and I just never did. But I think the idea was that it was also partially like some sort of government mind programming thing that would happen where you were playing that. There's always these little variations of like songs that will make you do things or games that will alter your mind or things like that.
Yeah, but like the format and the way that Creepypasta is disseminated into the world is like meant to fool you into believing it's real.
Yeah,
it's about
that
fuzziness between stuff you read on the internet in real life and, you know, like video games in real life where if you can keep your Pokemon with you in your pocket at all times, then they feel a little bit closer to you than the book that you've just finished reading.
The way that you're explaining it, it makes me think of, and I'm always making strange leaps occasionally, it feels like a magic trick, right? Like once you know the story behind a creepypasta, like the actual story behind a creepypasta, like there's no power to it all. The thing that makes it powerful is the fact that you want to be tricked.
Yeah.
No matter, even if you go like, this is absurd, there's a part of you that wants to be like, no, Ben drowned.
Yeah.
Ben drowned, Keisha.
Yeah. So the end of Smile Dog, if you haven't read Smile Dog, which is really great, it's Michael refers to it as the worst thing he's ever written, but I still think it's a good creepypasta. Smile Dog is this picture, blah, blah. Michael is writing about it as if it's him. He wants to see Smile Dog. He talks to the last person that has talked about having Smile Dog, and they tell them that after they looked at it, they started hearing voices and were compelled to urge it on, and in their dreams they can see this image of the horrifying dog with like horrible teeth. And then later they started having seizures. And then the day after they talk to them, they have a seizure so bad they die. Michael gets this mysterious email with the image in it. And he knows all he has to do in order to prevent himself from having that seizure and the horrible dreams is pass on the image afterwards. And so the last line of it is, would I do that to someone else? Would I give them this curse? Yes. And then when you scroll down, it's
picture
Smile Dog.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. It's going to be right there.
Yeah. And like that is the kind of thing, the kind of scare you really only get from like an internet thing.
It's that feeling of sort of sitting in front of a screen and getting slowly more drawn in and drawn in with like a blanket around you and then finally being like, oh no, I'm not where I'm supposed to be.
Yes, it's the feeling of taking something that was familiar, like your computer, the websites that you like to visit, and turning it into another source of horror.
Yeah, I don't...
You'd made the most upset face just then.
Yeah, I don't.
Heather's a gentle girl.
I don't like Halloween and, well, I like candy, but I don't like Halloween. Yeah. And I love scary games, but like in scary games,
yeah, you're
I
the
can,
only one out of us that can play scary games.
Yeah,
I can't
nobody
play scary.
Nobody at the office besides me, I think, or maybe Kirk has finished it too, is like Resident Evil 7 rules. And I played it in VR. It was my first time playing VR. And I was like, oh, they're trying to get me with chainsaws. This is great. And other people are like, this is scary. But like when you say creepypasta stuff or like Lord forbid, you were like, let's go to Williamsburg or whatever and like see a scary movie, I'd be like, oh no, like this is you have that adventure.
See, I love horror movies, but I cannot stand horror games. I like can't play them. I tried to play Amnesia the Dark Descent and I got to the very first scene where the monster happens, you can hear him breathing, and I force quit the game and then dragged the executable file into my trash and then emptied the trash.
It's still there.
No, it's not. No. Fuck you.
No, because the thing, okay, so I will say this. The thing that makes horror movies different than horror games for me, because if we want to talk about these sort of things very briefly, is in a horror movie, if some idiot is walking towards the closet that you know the monster is in, they're going to open it. Mm-hmm. If I'm playing a game, I can maybe go back and like explore a bit and grab a health pack before I have to open the scary closet.
Yeah,
and I find that very empowering.
In horror movies, you don't find a stash of armor and bullets right before they open the scary
door.
You're
not like, oh, this is a boss fight. Great. They're like behind you and right in your neck.
See, for me, it's the agency of having to open the door that I find terrifying.
Well, doors are terrifying in general. I think Kirk has written about that.
Yeah, Kirk wrote a great – Kirk Hamilton, editor at large, wrote a great
– Kirk Himmelbug.
Kirk Hamilton.
Crap Cribblebull.
Came in with the slam. Kirk wrote this great post about the anxiety of doors to horror games.
It's this fear of the unknown.
Yeah.
You know something is there.
Yeah.
But the what is the big question.
So that is what terrifies me about actually having to have the agency of deciding to open the door. That scares me so much. If I am watching someone else do it, I can just get into the themes of the story.
Sure.
I mean, the kind of horror movies that I like in general are more about a creeping sense of dread than being spooked or gore or stuff.
You're going to watch a Hellraiser and not a Saw.
Yeah, basically. That's the distinction you want to draw there. I'm a Get Out person. I'm not a Hostel person.
You want a Clive Barker and not a Stephen King.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Although I have to say, I do like Scream a lot.
Well, Scream's really fun. Scream's silly.
Scream's fun. It's a fun... Neve Campbell also is incredible.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Yeah, she's Neve Campbell.
What are you waiting for? What are you waiting for? I like Scream.
I love Scream. Scream 4 is also good. Have you seen Scream 4?
I don't have eyes.
That's true. It makes it very difficult for you to watch.
That's the creepypasta right now.
All right. On that note, I think we're going to start doing the end of the show.
Yeah, I think wrap up. That's fine.
So, Heather, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You are the best.
You are the best.
What?
No, you.
I'm going to fight
you. You hang up first.
So yeah, Heather's a staff writer at Kotaku.com, just like me. I'm also a staff writer.
It's a website for video games.
And snacks. And Overwatch fan theories.
Yeah, oh gosh. Yeah, new Overwatch character. I got some fan theories of my own.
Oh, about how she's your girlfriend now.
About how she's my girlfriend. And she yells at me.
So if you want to read that post next week, please go visit us on Kotaku.com. You can also send
us their expectations up.
You can, well, I'm definitely going to be writing about Mora next week. Anyway, you can send us an email if you have questions to favethis@kotaku.com or tweet it at me or Patricia with the hashtag favethis. You can find Patricia Hernandez's work. She's deputy editor of Kotaku on kotaku.com as well. So I wanted to read a review from our iTunes. This is from Black Daria. Excellent name, Black Daria.
She is.
I'm Black Jane Lane.
She is she's sassy, but also a little staid.
Yeah. So they used to call me Daria in high school. Actually, when we played volleyball, I would just stick my hand out and not do anything. And then they would sing at me, na, 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 na. Anyway, Black Daria, you and me, we'll get along. So the title of this review is So Pleasant. I love how kind and warm the hosts of this pod are. I can tell they're friends and conversations flow naturally. They're knowledgeable of what they're talking about and provide good insight. And thank you so much, Black Daria.
That's very good.
I love Patricia.
I love Patricia.
Patricia's really great.
She's really good.
I miss her.
She is ill. I'm filling in. I'm the anti-Patricia.
So if you want to leave us a review on iTunes, that would be very helpful. It really helps us with visibility. You can also find us on most places where podcasts are found, like Stitcher and Google Play. And we have a Spotify link now. You can listen to us on Spotify. I feel so
I want to look at that.
About that. So I also wanted to thank Mandana Mofidi, who is the executive director of audio. She's in the booth. She gave me a thumbs up just now. And our theme song, which was produced by Mellow Makes, want to thank him. And the interstitial like commercial music that was done by Stuart Wood. So big thanks to all of those people.
Yeah, thank you guys.
So make sure also to check out this week's Split Screen, which Kirk told me is the thing that they're talking about is Mario. They're talking about Mario.
All just big full letters, Mario.
It's happening. Mario's happening.
Yes.
And thanks so much for listening.
Yeah.
Y'all should tune in next week.
Yep. See you around, guys.
Bye.